I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Every year, the Free Library of Philadelphia picks a book for everyone to read, and the author is featured at events across the city. It's called One Book, One Philadelphia, and it's a celebration of literacy and reading. This year, it should be three books, One Philadelphia, because the author, Jacqueline Woodson, is an award-winning and prolific writer who writes for all ages. The library chose her picture book, This is the Rope, her memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, which won the National Book Award, and her latest novel, Another Brooklyn. I recently interviewed Jacqueline Woodson at the Logan branch of the Free Library in North Philadelphia, the right setting to talk about her writing and her life surrounded by books and passionate readers, especially Woodson fans. Another Brooklyn is about an anthropologist named August who goes back to Brooklyn for her father's funeral. That taps into her memories of growing up in Bushwick in the 1970s, her intense bond with three neighborhood girls, and her longing for her mother. Woodson's memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, written in verse, is about growing up in the South with her grandparents and moving to Brooklyn to live with her mother. We begin the show with Justice Cooper. She's an eighth grader at Logan Hope School reading from Brown Girl Dreaming. Then Jacqueline Woodson will read from her memoir and we'll talk about her family, about lying and writing, how words look on a page, friendship, adolescence, and being a young Jehovah's Witness.
Hi, my name is Justice Cooper and I read Brown Girl Dreaming. I really liked it because it had a lot of meaning and it made me think a lot. I wanted to share a poem I liked from the beginning of the book. It is called Second Daughter's Second Day on Earth. And I liked it because of how she describes the events that were happening during the civil rights movement and the men and women who were fighting for justice. In this poem, she wonders who she will grow up to be. It makes me think about the people who are fighting for justice now and who I want to grow up to be. Here it is. My birth certificate says female Negro, mother, Mary Ann Irby, 22, Negro, father, Jack Austin Woodson, 25, Negro. In Birmingham, Alabama, Martin Luther King Jr. is planning a march on Washington, where John F. Kennedy is president. In Harlem, Malcolm X is standing on a soapbox talking about a revolution. Outside the window of University Hospital, snow is slowly falling. So much already covers this vast Ohio ground. In Montgomery, only 7 years has passed since Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a city bus. I am born brown-skinned, black-haired, and wide-eyed. I am born Negro here and colored there. And somewhere else, the freedom singers have linked arms, their protests rising into song. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome someday. And somewhere else, James Baldwin is writing about injustice, each novel, each essay, changing the world. And I do not yet know who I'll be, what I'll say, how I'll say it. Not even 3 years has passed since a brown girl named Ruby Bridges walked into an all-white school. Armed guards surrounded her while hundreds of white people spat and called her names. She was 6 years old. I do not know if I'll be strong like Ruby. I do not know what the road will look like when I am finally able to walk, speak, write. Another Buckeye, the nurse says to my mother. Already, I am being named for this place. Ohio, the Buckeye State. My fingers curl into fists automatically. This is the way, my mother said, of every baby's hand. I do not know if these hands will become Malcolm's, raised and fisted. Or Martin's, open and asking. Or James, curled around a pen. I do not know if these hands will be Rosa's or Ruby's, gently gloved and fiercely folded, comb me in a lap, on a desk, around a book, ready to change the world.
Very well done. Very well done.
Thank you.
I would love to have you read from Brown Girl Dreaming, and this is one of the poems are called Writing Number One.
Okay. Writing number one, it's easier to make up stories than it is to write them down. When I speak, the words come pouring out of me. The story wakes up and walks all over the room, sits in a chair, crosses one leg over the other, says, "Let me introduce myself." Then just starts going on and on. But as I bend over my composition notebook, only my name comes quickly. Each letter neatly printed between the pale blue lines, then white space and air, and me wondering, how do I spell introduce? Trying again and again until there is nothing but pink bits of eraser and a hole now where a story should be.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. It's so great to read those passages about you being a little girl and discovering writing. You even have one of your verses is about the letter J. Of course, Jacqueline begins with J. Mm-hmm. But just what it was to discover what it meant to write on a page. Mm-hmm. Do you still feel that?
I think more what I feel now is grateful when the words come.
Truly?
You know, I know how to spell them. I know how to write them, but they're not always configured in my brain. But I definitely have that visceral memory of creating letters and words becoming sentences and sentences becoming paragraphs, and the absolute power of that, you know, that was my own power. So when I was writing Brown Girl Dreaming, I would have been remiss to not talk about that visceral feeling.
That kind of discovery. Mm-hmm. You've also talked about and written about having a teacher say to you in fifth grade, you can write.
Yeah. And of course,
what a gift that is, right?
It is. Both the teacher recognizing and your passion being legitimized, you know. And I often say that I think that's what brilliance is, that passion confirmed and seen. And I feel like that was the first time by a teacher that I was really seen.
And do you remember what you had written that she thought was so good?
It was a Martin Luther King poem. We were asked to write a poem about Martin Luther King. It was a contest. And I think it was for Black History Month, because at that time his birthday wasn't yet, even though it should have been a national holiday. But I had written the poem. I think some of it might be in the book. And I ended up winning first place, which was a Scrabble game.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. And that was, I remember my friend Barbara had won second place, and I think that was checkers. And I like checkers better than Scrabble. But I think I tried to trade with her, but I didn't really want to trade with her, because even though I liked that game better, it was second place. You know, it wasn't,
I got you.
It wasn't the grand prize, but yeah.
You write a bit about your sister, your older sister, mm-hmm. described as really gifted.
Yes.
Did you feel like you lived in her shadow as a little girl coming up?
My sister and I are very close in age, and we look a lot alike, and my mom used to dress us alike. And so we were often mistaken for twins. And outside of school, in school, I followed directly behind her from grade to grade. And she was the smartest kid in the school,
wow.
Like literally, and had been the smartest kid that teachers had seen in years and years, I mean, or so they say. But her claim to fame was there's a school in New York called Hunter High School, Hunter College High School, and she was the first kid in Bushwick to get into that school in probably 20 years or wow. something crazy. So when me coming along right after her, the teachers were very excited about another Woodson in the room. So I was definitely in her shadow until they realized.
What did they realize?
I was not Odella. I did not have her academic prowess. Right. You know, I was very different. I got in trouble for talking. I wanted to write all the time. I made up stories all the time, which they call lies. I was a very, very different kid.
And kind of living in the shadow of this
accomplished
older sister.
Yeah, definitely. And also, you know, it was the era of testing, of standardized tests. Mm-hmm. And my sister always says what she did well was she took tests well. She knew how to take tests. And I didn't. I knew how to engage in a different way, but I was not the kind of kid that knew how to take tests.
In your book, she's often reading.
Mm-hmm. She still reads a lot, yeah.
Were you a clever troublemaker?
It depends on who you ask. So I wasn't a troublemaker. You know, we weren't allowed to get in trouble, and we weren't allowed to fail, because my mom, if I did poorly in school, it would be the fault of my sister and older brother. And so they would be in trouble. So my mother's argument was, if you guys are so smart, this child needs to be right where you are. And so she would make them study with me. And of course, they were cranky about it. But I wasn't allowed, you know, to talk back to teachers or anything. But I was constantly, I was the kid who was always being asked to stop talking. You know, I was always whispering to someone or passing notes to someone or telling someone a story. And every time the teacher's back was turned, that was me, the one in class, disrupting somebody by having something I needed to tell them immediately.
You just were antsy, you think?
Yeah, I know. I just had a lot to say. You know, I had a lot I wanted to talk about, and I wanted... I was engaged. I think I was deeply engaged in the world in a way that I don't know that you had to. I didn't know how to compartmentalize yet. I didn't know how to shut off what I was seeing outside or what I was thinking last night or the dream I had or the thing I wanted to do tomorrow with what needed to happen right now.
You mentioned lies, and it's interesting to talk about lies and lying and liars and the times that we live in. But do you think liars make good novelists?
I think, of course, it's a good question. I think the stories do, one of the rules of writing is start with what you know, right? Mm-hmm. And you start with what you know, and you think of it in the context of the bigger world. And you can't navel gaze, right? It can't just be about your life. Who cares about the thing that only matters to you? And so I think that you can't be an egomaniac and be a writer. You can't be narcissistic and be a writer. You have to have a certain amount of deep empathy for the world and yourself in it to be able to see both where you are in this moment in time and your impact on a place. And so that's what, and then you have to be able to tell good stories. You have to be able to imagine characters in your head. So yeah, you can't, some liars do make good writers, but there are some other levels to that.
But as a little kid, and you're not the only one that told tall tales, was it just the thrill of it, of trying to get away with it or seeing its effect on
It was the reaction
people?
I got from people. So it was the surprise. It was the like, oh wow! It was that really, you know, it was a conversation.
What kind of, you've written so many books, but what kind of non-writing jobs have you had?
So it had
nothing to do with writing.
It was always words, though. So I worked as a word processing secretary for many years to make money, so that I could pay rent while I wrote. I worked with runaway and homeless kids as an doing drama therapy and art therapy. Mm-hmm. I've worked, you know, when I was a teenager, I worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken. I worked at Burger King. I worked at a place called Yoga Delight in the West Village. I worked at summer camps. I was the horseback riding instructor at a Girl Scout camp. I've had
You've
jobs since I was 14.
You're listening to my interview with Jacqueline Woodson, recorded at the Logan branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Woodson is the featured author for the Free Library's annual reading event, One Book, One Philadelphia. We've been talking about her memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, and her novel, Another Brooklyn. Check out our slideshow at whyy.org/radiotimes. More after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscow, and you're listening to a special edition of Radio Times, recorded earlier this month at the Logan branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia, featuring an interview with award-winning novelist and this year's chosen author for the library's One Book, One Philadelphia, Jacqueline Woodson. The two books we've been talking about are Woodson's memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, written in verse about her search to find her place in the world, and her novel, Another Brooklyn, set in the 1970s about a young teenager named August, also searching for her place in the world and her intense bond with three neighborhood girls.
Well, I saw a picture, it's on your website, of you as a 2-year-old.
Oh.
In an ad for.
Yes, I was a child model.
You were a child model. Yes.
So I was a spokesperson for Alaka Syrup for Ebony Magazine. So there was a whole series of ads where they passed me off as a 6-year-old, because I know the one that's on my website, I say, I wish they had Alaka Syrup at school, too. And it's, and the caption underneath is, Alaka Syrup is rich and wholesome, energy-giving dextrose for children like Jacqueline Woodson pictured above. It's like, basically, you're just saying that's sugar,
exactly.
And you should give it to your kids. But, yeah, so I don't know how that came about, but... some photographer photographed us all, and there's a group photo in One Ebony, where kids from all over the country are talking about their love of Alaka syrup. And right. We are the New York kids at that time, even though we weren't specifically New York just yet. And then from that, I did another series where it was just me. They chose one child, and she became the face of Alaka syrup.
Wow. How long did that go on?
I don't know. My mom only had two or three ads, but you know, the syrup finally, I think the syrup was trying to figure out itself again. At one point it was a cooking syrup, and I don't know what else happened to it. I was at a reading and someone brought up a jar of Alaka syrup for me.
I do want to talk about these two books, but I'm also interested in just literally how your books look and how the words look on the page. Mm-hmm. And you were on Radio Times a couple of years ago talking about mm-hmm. just how important that is to you, not just if it's a poem or some kind of a verse, but even in Another Brooklyn. It's important how it looks on the page, those words.
Mm-hmm.
How come?
I think that reading, when you read, you're using a lot of your senses, right? Just like when I'm writing, I'm using the sense of smell, the sense of touch, the mm-hmm. sense of hearing, and of course the sense of sight. And so when you first approach a page, the first thing you take into consideration for me is how many words are on it. Uh-huh. And how long are the sentences, and how much of it can I understand in one sitting. And when I write, it's the same thing. It's the question of how is this white space going to impact the story? If it's there, why is it there? What is it trying to say? Is this a paragraph that calls for very short sentences and a sense of urgency? Or is this more of a dream-like narrative, mm-hmm. which means that the sentences should be longer? And again, how do the words sound? So everything I write, I read out loud, but I also look at how I decide. I'm very intentional about how I set it up on the page.
So that, and there are blank spaces as a kind
the
of
white space. Yeah,
a pause.
It's a pause. It's a moment to reflect and to just think about what you've read before, mm-hmm. or to let that sink in, or to. Sometimes it's a time gap. But the white space, when you think of poetry, it is that moment. It's also the unknown, right? Mm-hmm. What we don't know is that silence, and it's speaking to that.
When did you decide, or when did you feel like, I am a writer? Was it in fifth grade, or did that come later on?
Tomorrow.
Still a struggle?
I think it's like coming out, right? It's something that happens over time and again, and you have the doubt, and then you're certain. I know I'm a writer. I know I'm a storyteller. I'm always surprised when people are reading my books. I'm always surprised when I get certain recognition. And I always have this thing in the back of my head that the recognition is for those books. Those are stories that I've told. And so what's in me now? What's next? And will I be able to write the next book? And I think every writer struggles with this, right? You have the proof that you have nothing, right? Because you've never published a book, and then you've published a book, but is this going to be the only book you publish? Right. And then you publish another one. It's like, yeah, so now what? and it goes on and on. I think the doubt stays with me. But I do think I'm at a point where I know I have some things to say.
Have you ever struggled with what they call writer's block?
I don't believe in writer's block. I think what people have named is fear. And a fear mm-hmm. of someone not liking what you wrote, a fear of someone judging you, a fear of someone thinking that happened to your family and you're telling, a fear of your family saying, don't air our dirty laundry, whatever it is. But I think there is a way in which we self-censor ourselves, mm-hmm. In which we self-censor, but and then we name it writer's block. So it's that question. I always say, when I get to that point where I feel like I can't do this, I write down what I'm most afraid of. And I say to myself, no one is ever going to see this. So if no one's ever going to see it, what is the thing you would write? And that helps unlock.
Oh, that's I think something we could all use in our daily lives. I do think of writing as a solitary endeavor. I'm assuming for most writers, some like to go to the, you know, McDonald's and write there, surrounded by people. Some people like to be quiet by themselves. Mm-hmm. But then here you are, surrounded by people who have read your books.
Uh-huh.
What is that like? I mean, to go from that quietness to this.
It's interesting. It's great. I mean, I love that people turn out and that we can have dialogues about the work. I love that I've created work that people want to engage in. I love that my work speaks across lines of race and class and gender and sexuality and all these ways in which people can see mirrors of themselves in the literature, or windows into new worlds, as Dr. Dean Simms Bishop talks about. And I'm pretty shy. You know, I love the barrier of the microphone. I love a nice podium in front of me.
Oh, that you can hide behind.
Yeah, yeah. But it's phenomenal. I love that we're still a country of readers, and mm-hmm. we're still hungry for the engagement that literature allows us to have.
What I so appreciate about your writing, and there are many things, but one is how you understand so deeply and have such a great passion for teenage girls. And I think for so many people, they just want to get through that period, mm-hmm. move on, never think about what mm-hmm. happened, and hope to never relive that. But you just explore that.
And I'm then thinking, we have children.
And then you have children, and you have to do it all over again. But certainly in Brown mm-hmm. Girl Dreaming, we have Maria. And in Another Brooklyn, we have Sylvia, Angela, and Gigi. And these are just such wonderful friends.
Yeah. I love creating those characters. And it's interesting what you say about kind of shutting out the adolescence, right? Because yeah. that is one of the most painful times of coming of age. And it is. It's like, get this behind me. But we do compartmentalize again, right? Mm-hmm. And so somewhere locked in our brain is that pain. And for me, in order to get through any kind of pain, I write through it and I get to the other side of it and process it, and it becomes cathartic. Mm-hmm. And so I think the teen years, one of the many reasons is I go back there is they're so formative. They decided everything about who I was going to become. And with Another Brooklyn, you think about the friendships of young people, especially young girls, and how important those friendships right. are. And I really wanted to go back to that place and write from that perspective.
I'd love to have you read a section from Another Brooklyn that speaks to just that point.
It was during this summer that I first saw Sylvia, Gigi, and Angela. The three of them walked down our block dressed in halter tops and shorts, arms linked together, heads thrown back, laughing. I watched until they disappeared, wondering who they were, how they became. My mother had not believed in friendships among women. She said women weren't to be trusted. Keep your arm out, she said, and keep women a whole other hand away from the furthest tips of your fingernails. She told me to keep my nails long. But as I watched Sylvia, Angela, and Gigi walk past our window, I was struck with something deeply unfamiliar, a longing to be a part of who they were, to link my own arm with theirs and remain that way forever.
I love that section. I mean, it's really about what it feels to fall in love, mm-hmm. don't you think?
I do think that. I think, who is it, the Langston Hughes poem, I love my friend, he went away from me, there's nothing more to say, the poem ends just as it began, I love my friend. And I do think, I have a village back in Brooklyn, and I love each of them so deeply, and even my friends from childhood, who I still am close to, I can't imagine walking the world without them. Even the ones I've lost, I can't imagine not having that history of having walked through the world with them. So yeah, it is, I think friendship is its own love story. And that's definitely a love right. story, and it's a story of broken hearts, it's a story of betrayal, it's a story of memory.
Of memory. Oh, mm-hmm. memory is so important and so so elusive. I mean, I'm at the age where I don't remember anything, and the things that I do remember, I don't trust if they ever happened or not.
That's so funny. It was funny because I was talking to my sister. I wrote written this piece in the Times about working at a restaurant when I was 15 and going to clubs in the city. And my sister's like, you have such an imagination because you never worked at Yogurt Delight. And I was like, what? And so, you know, I started showing her all these pictures of me in my apron. I'm like, but you were there, duh. And right. She's like, I don't remember it. And it was so interesting that she had whited out this whole period in time where we both worked at this same place. I mean, she left probably about a year into me working there, and then I had my own whole life at this restaurant. But it was really fascinating that it was a blank slate for her.
Yeah. And in Another Brooklyn, these girls, they're just inseparable. Mm-hmm. And they have big dreams. I mean, they have dreams of the future. And as you say, you know, not everything works out.
Uh-huh. And they constantly walk through the book with their arms linked, which was also very intentional in that, you know, kind of when you think of the civil rights era and that letting the circle not be broken. Like, these girls had a lot of strength when they were linked together.
You mentioned gaze, and I think in Another Brooklyn, there's a lot about looking. Mm-hmm. At one point, she and her brother are looking out of the window once they've moved to Brooklyn. And the father, it's all painted shut. Mm-hmm. The father kind of lets them look out the window, but they can't go outside, but they can see the world out there.
Yeah, and they just watch it, which I think reflects a lot of characters and past books I've written, that sense of watching the world from this outside place. I mean, they're inside watching it, but I think a lot of my characters are gazers, are watching the world and taking it in and trying to figure out who they are in the context of it.
And obviously they're teenage girls, and so there are teenage boys and older boys in that, and they are gazing at them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And preteens. I mean, that's one of the things the book is talking about, the danger of being a growing up girl in this country, and in many countries, sadly, where your growing is much more visible to the world. So you walk through the world and people are looking at you and you don't understand what this gaze is about yet. You know, they say something about the swivel of their heads or the way they move their arms suggests more to the world than they understand. And I think that's the truth for a lot of young women.
Did you feel that as a teenage girl?
You know, I as a teenage girl, I was with my girl. So there's one scene where it's like when boys called our names, we said, "Don't even say our name. Don't even put it in your mouth." And and it was that kind of constant clap back at the world that I remember. But I do remember being alone. I remember you know, someone flashing me on the subway. And it's so funny because my daughter's 15 now, and when she was 13, she was taking the subway to school with her friends, and she was going in the opposite direction than rush hour, so it wasn't crowded. And I was like, you know, Toshi, one day you might get on the subway and there might be this guy and he'll be wearing a trench coat or something. He'll have a briefcase and, you know, and he'll expose himself. And she's like, "Mommy, that happened to your day. That doesn't happen anymore." Literally 3 weeks later, she comes home and she's like, "Mommy, he even had a briefcase." And she said, her friends were so upset that their moms had to come and get them. And she's like, "What's wrong with them? Don't they even know about flashers?" But no one had that conversation. But I'm like, the world has not changed in so many ways. But I remember that kind of, you know, that kind of vulnerability where, like, I felt like I had done something wrong because why had that person chosen me? But then again, when I was with my girls, if I had been with my girls, it would have been a different story.
Yeah, you would have taken them on.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely would have. Yeah.
And I didn't realize flashers had uniforms, but now I see that they do. Looking at these two books, in your memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, your mom leaves the family for a while. Mm-hmm. You're living with your grandparents. She goes to New York. And in this book, Another Brooklyn, the mother is absent. Mm-hmm. And August pines for her mother, misses her deeply.
Yeah.
Does it make you think about the kind of mother you are, want to be?
I hope my kids are missing me now. So it does. It makes me think about presence. It makes me think about, just the impact of mother on child. And when I was writing Brown Girl Dreaming, one thing that I realized is, where some of my other books came from, like Coming on Home Soon. Coming mm-hmm. on Home Soon is a picture book that takes place during World War II, but the mother leaves the child with the grandmother so she could go work the railroads. And I thought, I was writing it because I had read all these Rosie the Riveter stories, and I would ask myself, well, where are the black women? You know, we knew we were there, so what were we doing? Then I did this research and found out. But it is a story of a child missing her mom and the mom saying, and hoping the mom is going to be coming on home soon.
Yeah.
And I miss my mother so deeply when she would go to New York and we would cry and we'd want to go with her. And then we got to New York and I miss my grandparents so much. When I was writing Brown Girl Dreaming, my mom died suddenly. She was 68. And I think when I was writing Another Brooklyn, I was still in that grieving process. I mean, it's one of the reasons I think I investigate the rituals of death and dying in other cultures, because I do feel like we live in a culture where you get a moment to grieve, right? And then you're supposed to be okay, you're supposed to be beyond it, and you're supposed to get back to work and move on with your life. And then you look at these other cultures where they take the time it takes to get back into being. Mm-hmm. But the child, August, in Another Brooklyn, is in a deep denial of sorts, but it makes sense that she's always been studying death, that then she goes on to become an anthropologist.
Yeah, with an expertise in mm-hmm. in death and dying mm-hmm. and death rituals.
We'll get back to my interview with Jacqueline Woodson after this very short break. We're talking at the Logan Branch Library in North Philadelphia about writing and her life in an interview recorded earlier this month with an overflow audience. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let's get back to my interview with writer Jacqueline Woodson and hear what members of the audience at the Logan Branch Library wanted to ask.
You do write for adults. You write for teenagers, and you also write for young kids as well. When you're writing, I mean, do you know which group you're writing for when you start out? Does it matter?
No, that's a really good question where the answer, I feel like, has changed over time. Mm-hmm. And now I don't always know how it's going to get marketed.
Oh, is it about marketing?
I think it is. I mean, I know when I'm writing a picture book, because it's very visual to me. And it's poetry. When you look at any of my picture books, that winter snow fell on everything, turning the world a brilliant white. One morning, the principal came in, and she had a girl with her and said, "This is Maya." Maya looked down at the floor. I think I heard a whisper, "Hello." You know, I see the line breaks. I see Maya coming into the room. I see the other girl moving her books away from her. And I really see how the story moves from line to line. But that happened with Brown Girl Dreaming, and it wasn't a picture book. It was a story of memory. And I realized that memory does come to us in these small moments with all this white space around it. But then we get to Another Brooklyn, which is not in the verse form, but it's very poetic. And so then who is this for? But I knew that because August was an adult looking back on her life, that would make it an adult book. Because for young adult fiction, you're in the moment of the child's age.
I know you live in Brooklyn that wasn't the Brooklyn that you grew up in. Mm-hmm. How do you see where you live now?
The neighborhood I live in now?
Yeah.
It wasn't the neighborhood I moved to.
Right.
So when I moved to Park Slope, it was really diverse. And now we're the only family of color on our block.
Really?
Which breaks my heart. It's hard because I love New York so much, and I love Brooklyn so much, and I want my kids to experience the Brooklyn that I knew as a child, but it's gone, you know, and so it's hard to find the kind of diversity. And when you look at my school pictures, I mean, there were Latino kids, there were Black kids, there were German kids, there were Italian kids, Robert Sack, who was Irish. And you don't see school pictures like that so much anymore.
It is sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sad. But it is interesting about this notion of going home. I mean, in certain ways, writing books like this is like going home.
It is. I love being able to go back to the past. I mean, for Bushwick, I had to do a lot of research to get back to that period of time because, I don't know if I said this last night, but all the Bushwick part of that book is all nonfiction. It's a biography of Bushwick. And so everything in it about Bushwick is true. And then over that, I wanted to lay a narrative. And so I created the four girls, Sandra, August, Gigi, and Angela, which is Saga, and put them into this real place. And then over that, I wanted to lay the element of poetry. And so hence the white space and the way the sentences fall on the page. But I did go back and research Bushwick a lot, not just rely on memory, to see what it, to help me remember what it was at that time.
In Brown Girl Dreaming, you grew up in Jehovah's Witness. And in another Brooklyn, August brother is Muslim.
And dad.
And dad is Muslim. How religious are you, or do you have religious
feelings? I actually grew up Jehovah's Witness and Muslim, because when my uncle came, my uncle had been incarcerated, and when he came back from prison, he had converted to the Nation of Islam. And so we had, so my mom, assuming, I guess, that there wasn't enough religion in the family already, you know, we ended up practicing both religions. And so I did grow up reading the Bible and the Quran.
Wow.
And I still don't eat pork. I still don't pledge the flag. I celebrate every single holiday. So, and my partner is Jewish but secular now. Right. So you know, we celebrate Kwanzaa, we celebrate Hanukkah, we celebrate Christmas. Jacqueline Woodson's birthday month is February.
It's the 12th,
needs to send
I think.
Me anything.
Yeah, yeah. The 12th, right?
Yeah, me and Judy Blume and Lincoln. But I consider myself much more spiritual. I mean, I'm so grateful for the upbringing I had in terms that it really showed me that I believe, like Walt Whitman, argue not concerning God, and I, you know, I feel like I have a deep belief in people's beliefs, and so my kids, you know, one child doesn't believe in God, the other one does, and I'm like, you are who you are. So, but I definitely, I'm definitely, I spend a lot of time being very grateful.
A nice place to be. I love the scenes in here as a young girl and you knocking on people's doors to deliver the good news.
Yes.
This is such a broad generalization, but there are lots of Jehovah's Witness in and around. I notice in transportation part of Philadelphia. Yeah. Honestly, they're the nicest people I've ever had any pleasure to interact with.
It's interesting because when we were growing up, we went door to door. We went out in field service. And I think they've kind of satellited now. I think part of it is the danger of going door to door. But in New York City, they're in the train stations. And when I was in Germany, they're by public transportation. But yeah, I think one thing about Jehovah's Witnesses is they're kind. You know, they're patient and they're kind, and I think it really helped me figure out not only how to sit for hours, because it's a text-based religion, so you're spending a lot of time studying the text. So sitting for hours and studying the text, but also learning how to explain, you know, and I feel like when I'm writing, I have deep patience for taking my time to get the narrative on the page. And also, when I'm arguing with people, I'm very patient.
That helps. So when you were in church, you were quiet. You
Kingdom
weren't
Hall.
Yeah, you weren't speaking out. Kingdom Hall. You weren't talking the way you were in school?
No. We weren't. We would get in so much trouble. But it taught me how to be bored. which was such a gift, and how to go inside my head and create narrative and imagine places that I could be. I remember one time, so at the Kingdom Hall we went to, people had to, if you were late, so say people came in late, they would leave the front seats empty. And the people coming in late would have to walk past so everyone could see them. And so my grandmother was always like, we can't be late, we can't. And we were always late. But I remember one time this girl who would torture me in school, just torture me. She was at our same Kingdom Hall. And my brother and I, Roman and I, were very close. We're still very, very close. And the child had gone to the bathroom, and she must have been about 8 years old. We were the same age. We were both about 8 years old. And she came out of the bathroom, and her skirt was stuck in her underwear. And one of her underwear, well, you know, her underwear was kind of bunched up. But anyway, so she was in the front row. And so she walked through the whole Kingdom Hall like that. And so I'm 8 years old, and my brother is 6 or 5 or something. And we're crying, like we're crying because she's so mean to us, and we don't know that, you know, we don't know do unto others yet, or, you know, any of turn the other cheek. You know, we're just like, we're feeling like she's getting her just desserts. And so we're crying, and we can't stop laughing. And I'm sure some of the young people know about when that moment when you can't stop laughing, and you know your mother's going to beat you behind when you get home. You know, like, everyone in the congregation is looking at you, but, like, tears are coming out of her eyes. And she sits down, and she realizes it, and she looks back at us and gives me the finger. Like, it's my fault.
At Kingdom Hall.
At the Kingdom Hall. But I think that's one of my favorite memories, and also one of my most painful, because we got in so much trouble. But that's kind of
that's a great story.
It was. I've never written it, but it's clear as day. Because I think as an adult, I have so much guilt about laughing at her. But I'm like, but you were 8, Jackie. It was okay.
Yeah. You should definitely write that. I think we have a question.
How would you write about this year? Beginning January 17th, or whatever. What, you know, inauguration today.
Today.
What stories would you tell, or what would your children say if they were writers?
How would I write about now? I don't know. You know, I think for me right now, it's the question of self-preservation. And I think that I recommend that for everyone. I think there is this way in which information is coming at us so fast and so violently that it's shutting down our action. And I think for me, it's, we don't have TV, but it's kind of turning off the forces that are coming against me. And in that way, being able to get clarity to have some access to what's happening. But you know, every few minutes, something else is coming, you're bombarding you. And so it is about taking, in order to, what's the saying, you know, put on your mask before helping others, right? So I think all of us have to really think about what we're doing to take care of ourselves in this moment so that we can do something greater.
Great. We have another question all the way in the back there. Yes.
Yeah, hi. I wonder if you had any memories of school libraries? And librarians, we're currently without librarians in our public schools, and mm-hmm. we're going to try to get them back with through legislation in Harrisburg.
Sure. Absolutely. Libraries.
Yeah, so I grew up in the public library. At our school, at PS 106, we had a library that was stocked full of books, and a librarian named Miss Eisenberg, who did not let us touch them. She would take them off the shelf. She would read them to us. And I don't know how much she liked children. when I went back to that school as an adult, the library room had closed down. And it was closed for many, many, many years. And it completely broke my heart, because even though Miss Eisenberg was not the kindest woman, we had a library, and we had access to books through her, but we had access to books, and we had a library. And I had never imagined my school not having a library, even though it was in an underserved neighborhood. Then the Robin Hood Foundation came in, and they built a beautiful library in the school. And I was really excited about that. And then I came back to the school again, and that beautiful library didn't have any books in it. Because they built the structure, but there wasn't that grant to get books. So again, my heart was broken. And now it's somewhere in between. And I've gone to so many schools across the country that don't have school libraries. And it's a huge difference when schools have libraries and when schools don't. You see it in the children. You see it in how they are able and not able to gather. You see it, you know, I'll go to a school with a library and all the kids will meet me in a circle in the library. I'll go in another school and we're sitting on the cafeteria floor, or we're sitting in a very cold, half-empty auditorium, and there's not that engagement going on. The public library in my neighborhood was our home. We had to go there after school and stay until my mother picked us up at 5:45 because she was a single mom who worked full-time. And that's the case. That was the case for a lot of kids living during that time and now. So one of the things as ambassador, you know, I'm trying to talk more about not only school libraries, but classroom libraries, how there's so many classrooms where they're not small libraries in the classrooms and no school library. So kids are getting it on both ends of not having access to literature. And fortunately, organizations like First Book and We Need Diverse Books are trying to do work to kind of fill some of those gaps.
Such an important question. Yes, we have another question there. Yes.
I'm wondering about your interpretation about a quote from another Brooklyn. You said that the tragedy is not in the moment. It's in the memory. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me what that means to you personally?
I think when we're living in a moment, we don't know exactly what that moment is or what it's going to mean to us later on. And then as we live with it and grow up and grow old with it, we look back on it and we see, oh, this was kind of tragic. Mm-hmm. But in that moment, especially as young people, because we're so resilient, it's like we just press past it.
And understand it. I want to have you read Brown Girl Dreaming.
Okay. Who is this brown girl dreaming, my teacher wants to know, staring out the window so, head in hands and eyes, gone from here. Where are you, dear? Come back to the classroom, my pretty brown girl. I fear you're halfway around the world. Where is that mind of yours now? Outside, the window stabs through the air, sneaks past the classroom window pane, and there, beneath a truck, a frozen bird being sniffed by a stray cat. I don't yet know the word disdain. But in this moment, the world feels far away. I dream of stepping out into it one day to rest my feet in unfamiliar sand, to touch the hand of a boy or girl on the other side, where it's nighttime now or summer there. And maybe return to this place a different girl with just a trace of who I used to be echoing somewhere nearby to me. And as the teacher goes on and on, her words are suddenly becoming a poem that I might sing in an orange, that I might sing on an orange afternoon inside a room where people will know my name.
A great place to end our conversation. Jacqueline Woodson, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Jacqueline Woodson, the featured author for this year's One Book, One Philadelphia. We focus on two of her three books chosen this year, Woodson's memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, and her latest novel, Another Brooklyn. Thanks to everyone at the Logan branch of the Free Library and to the four students from Logan Hope School who welcomed Jacqueline and the audience to the taping. Our engineers for this special event, Joyce Lieberman and Adam Staniszewski. Diana Martinez, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Christine Holbert is WHYY's member relations coordinator. Radio Times' John Ahrens produced and edited this interview. Go to our homepage, whyy.org/radiotimes, to see a slideshow of this interview. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.